This today and tomorrow is going to be on a theme. And the theme is going to be interpersonal relationships. For some, it may be interpersonal conflict. Now, I don't know anything, okay? Nobody fed me any data and said, you know, Biff and Mabel, they really have these issues here, so I want you to speak on this particular subject because we really need to get this couple right. I don't have that data. As far as I know, you all are nearly perfect. As far as I know, you're entirely sanctified almost. That's all I know. And so if I say something that sounds like you, then just take that from the Lord, because I don't have any data. So I want you to know that, because this is going to be a little touchy for some of you, I imagine. It's going to be a little sensitive for some, I would imagine. And so, but I want you to know that. I don't have any data on you. And so this is just what I believe that the Lord wants me to share with you all. And if it applies, let it apply. Say, oh Lord, help me, and that would be great. And so I'm going to be talking about interpersonal relationships, interpersonal conflict, people not getting along, people choosing not to get along, people that don't like each other, whether it's within this body or your family or your extended family or your friends or people at work. And I know that it does apply to you all because you're like me. You're an Adamic person, fallen, regenerated by the power of God, but yet not yet perfected. And so we do have our issues in our relationships. And so I know that it is applicable, even though I don't know anything about any of you specifically. So with that in mind, what I want to talk about first are these two words right here. The two words are sympathy and empathy. By the way, I've never given this talk before, and so I mentioned to Rachel last night that I'll be doing this, and I said that. I've never given this talk before. And she said, we're just a group of guinea pigs, and so thank you. If any of you squeal, just go ahead and squeal. That's what guinea pigs do. And if you squeal and run out the door, we may have to come get you. But nevertheless, this will be new, and so I trust that it will be beneficial for you. And I cannot overemphasize my subtitle. You must know this. It sounds kind of bland and plain, but as I go through this, the subtitle may be even bigger than the title. You must know what I am going to share with you, because what I'm going to share, it can be the difference between spiritual life and spiritual death, and this is a very important topic. And so let me give you the big idea, and then that will set the trajectory of where we want to go. Now, by the way, I do, for those of you who take notes, I mean, please could take notes, do that. That's fantastic. But if you want these slide presentations, you can have them. Matt Huerta has them. Just wait till after I'm done, okay? Don't go over to him now. But you can have these slide presentations of what I speak to you about today and tomorrow. And that would be great. I'd love for you to have them if it will help you. And you can print them off in PDFs and mark them up. You can use them in your own ministry, in your own family, and that would be absolutely great. All right, so here's the big idea. If you do not have a working definition of sympathy and empathy, and more vitally, a practical application of those two words, you may do much harm to those who need your care the most. Now, I do want you to know, I am not the word police, and so it's irrelevant to me if you use those words. It's not important to me if you use those words and get them, whichever one you like, sympathy or empathy. That matters not to me. But what does matter is that you understand what you're doing to someone, that you understand what you want to accomplish in another person's life. That is what really matters. This presentation is an exploration in clearing up the ambiguity between sympathy and empathy. And so I want to talk about these two words. One of them's good, one of them is just awful. And understanding those differences can really be transformative for you. And so let's start by talking about the word sympathy. The etymology of the word, if you go back and study the word, you'll find three words that are connected to it. The three words are with and feeling and suffering. Now, I'm going to explain this in just a moment, and I'll give you plenty of illustrations to help understand what sympathy is. But the three words, and there's a linkage here. There's a sequence here. It's with, and then it's feeling, and then it's suffering, okay? And so that is the linkage. And the big word in what you see here on the screen is the word with, the preposition with. That's the most important word. Well, in this talk, it's the most important word. So two or more people with, they are together, they're with each other. And Estonia, would you tell me, you were very winsome and friendly. So what's your first name?
Gloria.
And your husband?
Dylan.
Dylan and Gloria. Okay, I need some illustrations. And so Dylan and Gloria, I know that y'all were, you were perfectly matched. Are you married?
Yes.
Y'all are married. Yes. You have children?
Not yet.
Okay. On the way. Really?
Yeah.
How on the way? Okay, so from a theological... Gloria, let me re-ask the question. I want you to think carefully about the question I just asked you. Oh, let me give you... You answered it wrongly, okay? All right, so let me ask you. So this will help. All right, so do you have children?
Yeah.
You have a 21-week, not year... child, congratulations, Dylan and Gloria. Awesome. Good. And all these people with children, this corner over here is just rejoicing with you, or maybe, or praying for you. But congratulations. All right, so Dylan and Gloria are together. They're really together. They are with. They're with. And they're feeling. They're understanding the suffering, the difficulty that is happening. So we will say Dylan is having an issue and Gloria wants to help Dylan. And so Gloria is with Dylan and he's feeling. And the feeling here is not this postmodern weird world that we live in today. The word feeling means understanding. That's the real definition of what we're getting at here. And so it's understanding the person, but understanding them specifically is understanding the suffering that Dylan is going through, that's happening to them. And so that's the linkage, that's the sequence that you see here with feeling and suffering. Let me give you an illustration here of a doctor applying medicine. We'll put it in the physical medical world instead of the spiritual world. He's applying medicine to a wound. Now, the doctor is with the person, and he understands the problem, and by implication, he goes beyond understanding to bring restorative care. And so, it's coming alongside them. And so, Rachel has an issue, probably many, I would imagine. But again, I have no data on you, but I'm just guessing. And so I'm with her. I'm right here with her, and I'm trying to understand what is going on in her heart. Or in this case of this illustration, she has a physical issue, and I want to understand it and then apply the appropriate restorative medical care. And so that's the illustration. Now, if it coming alongside the person and not understanding them or understanding them and not delivering restorative care, that would be incomplete sympathy. So those three parts are important. And so I could go to Rachel and I'm with her. I'm right here and I'm understanding her problem, but I don't deliver the goods. I don't help her. So that's not sympathy. That's two-thirds sympathy. And two-thirds sympathy is almost no sympathy at all. And so those three words are crucial. And so that's a good illustration of sympathy. And now let's take a look at the word empathy. And you'll see just one word change. And it's the preposition. As I said earlier, it's the most important word in this linkage here, according to this conference, this talk that I'm giving. And so the three words are in, preposition in, and feeling, which we now know what I mean is understanding, and then suffering. And so you could say you can infuse or assimilate are two helpful words to understand the preposition in. And so now it's not just being with her, beside her, but I'm jumping in her. Now, I want to explain what that means, because that is a huge problem in soul care, in discipleship. This is a big problem. We don't want Jesus to do that to us, and we don't want to do that to other people, as I will explain. Now, the way I want to illustrate this is I want to flip empathy around and illustrate it from the disciplee's perspective. And it looks like this. I'm using the word victim. If you flip empathy around and look at it from the victim's perspective, they project their pain, themselves and their pain, into the helper. And that's what I mean by assimilation. By assimilation, being in. And so now we're just like this, in, not beside. If the counselor or discipler does not become like the hurting person, as in a mirror image of the hurting person, then they are not genuinely empathetic. And you'll hear it sometimes in the statement, well, you just don't understand me. Meaning you're not in my pain. And again, once you go down that road, you're going to find yourself in a lot of hurt. Typically, the expectant recipient of empathy has understanding them as the number one thing they want from a soul care provider. Just understand me. Now, I am not saying that understanding is unimportant. Go back to the linkage again. With understanding and suffering. But it has everything to do with the preposition. You can understand a person by being outside of their context and have understanding. Or, as this person wants you to do, I want you to jump into my narrative. And if you jump into their narrative, then it's going to be a problem. The best illustrations of empathy have something to do with jumping in with the hurting person to know them according to how the sufferer wants you to understand them. The victim determines the kind of care they receive as opposed to a sympathetic doctor. And so now in this illustration, Rachel is telling me how to care for her the way that she wants to be cared for. Because now I'm in with her, understanding it the way she understands it. And so I have a myopic care because I can only see it the way she sees it. I need expansive care. I need comprehensive care. I need to not only understand what is going on in her life, but I need to understand what she cannot see. And if I come at the situation from an empathetic position, so Gloria could say to Dylan, just understand me. And Gloria just sees it. Are you okay with this? Okay, good. Okay. Gloria just sees it like this, like a horse, no offense, with blinders on. And then Dylan, he has to understand her the way Gloria wants him to understand her. But what Gloria really needs is for Dylan to understand her. Everything she knows and all she doesn't know. She's not in, but she's with alongside. And that is a huge difference. Now, in our culture today, we're having this with the transgender issue. For example, just as an illustration, perhaps you have heard of patient directed care, where the patient tells you what the problem is, and they tell you what to do for them. And so it's like, I'm doing a talk next week in Longmont on transgenderism, and so I've been thinking about that, I think my subtitle is going to be, I think, therefore I am. I think that I am a transgender, therefore I am. And so if the patient is the one that determines the outcome, that has never happened. That should never happen. But if the patient only permits you to understand them with no comprehensive understanding, then you can only give them what they expect you to give them, and you're limited in what you can provide. The victim determines the kind of care they receive, as opposed to the sympathetic doctor. I've shared this story before. When my son Hayden back here got a splinter in his toe, and he wanted me to understand that this thing is painful. And from his perspective, he didn't want anybody to touch his toe. You don't understand. But actually, I do understand. I understand that splinter is painful, but I understand more than you do, five-year-old. I understand if we don't get that splinter out, you may lose your toe. And so a sympathetic doctor would come along and truly understand the suffering that he is going through and not be unkind. I'm making no case for harshness, no case for lack of compassion. I'm not making that case. But I am making a case for sturdy disciplers, sturdy doctors who can lead and see more than what we may see. And so therefore, because I was not able to help him because it was so deep and so big, I called our medical doctor friend who came over, who understood the problem from a sympathetic perspective. And so he pulled out his sympathetic razor and he sliced his unsympathetic toe and it just opened up and he pulled the thing out and Hayden was yelling to high heaven. And then the sympathetic doctor sprayed the sympathetic spray on his toe. And then within moments, Hayden was doing Hayden stuff, which means walking around upright, mobile, moving, which is his life. And he was happy. If he had an empathetic doctor, the doctor would have like, oh, I don't want to hurt you. What I'm going to do is going to hurt, and I don't want to do that. That is the worst kind of discipleship that you can provide for someone. Not being uncaring, remember, understanding? We're understanding, but we're with them. We're not in them. And so we have to determine there is a temptation here when someone says, you don't understand me. This statement, it can be kind of laced with manipulation. It can be, not always, but it can be. And so you have to determine, your child is drowning, what will you do? Now, for those of you who have taken life-saving courses for drowning victims, you know, this was from a magazine article I read some time ago. It says, if you witness someone drowning, most emergency responders agree that what you need to do is look around for something buoyant before you even get in the water. Get in a boat or try to throw the drowning person something from shore. Swimming to someone who's drowning and trying to take hold of them is dangerous even for professionals. If you jump into their problem as a soul care provider, it is dangerous even for professionals. There's a reason why lifeguards carry that orange plastic buoy. It's not their need to accessorize. Throwing a drowning person something to keep them afloat so they don't hang on you is essential. This is common sense. And so empathy would say, I'm going to just jump in because I really want to understand. And if I get in that lake with you or get in that ocean with you and I flail around like you flail around, I will know exactly what you're going through. And we both drown. Or you can be sympathetic and throw them your accessory. Understanding a person is more complex than understanding a person. As I was saying earlier, you see what they see and you see what they cannot see. This is one of the things that we try to instill into our mastermind students, our all online training course, where we train folks to do discipleship. Many of you are familiar with it. And one of the things that we try to instill in them is that you have to see what they see, understand them, and you have to see what they cannot see. It's out of context, but that's okay. I take scripture out of context every now and then, but I just love this verse. It's in Hebrews 11. It's about verse 25, 26 right in there. But I just love that verse where it says, Moses, seeing him who is invisible, was not afraid of the king, Pharaoh. Moses could see. He had this vision. He could see the invisible. I love that. And we have to see the invisible. We have to see what can I. Y'all are looking me up. I just made that address up, Hebrews 11. There's two of you looking for it. All right, go ahead. I think it's 11:25. I'm going to go 11:26. And I'm going 11:27 on that. What is it? I'm going 11:27. That's my final offer.
27.
Called it. 27. 11:27. Seeing him who is invisible. Love that verse. Love it. That is such a faith-infusing verse to see God who is invisible, because that's how we live. That is how we live. But in a counseling context, we need God to help us to illuminate our minds so that we can see what we can't see with that person that's sitting across from us. I just finished an interesting book that I've been talking about to our community by Malcolm Gladwell. Not a Christian book, but it's called Talking to Strangers. And it talks about the impossibility of knowing if a person is telling the truth or not. The percentage is about somewhere between 44 and 54%. On a good day, 44 and 64% as to whether, for the people who can actually tell if a person is telling the truth. 54% of FBI agents can tell if a person is telling the truth. That's not good. The point is, you can't tell if a person is really telling the truth or not. And so when you are speaking with someone and you're trying to understand them, we need God's empowerment. We need God's Spirit working, giving us discernment so that we can understand not just what they're going through, but also understanding what they cannot see. You parents, you do this all the time. I just illustrated it with a splinter in the toe. But your children, they come to you and it's like, Mama, this is what's going on. And you can think 30 years down the road based on this incident right here. And if you jump in with that child, you'll probably give him a cookie or let him watch his TV show and continue to spoil him. But you're thinking, no, this is not good. I understand what you're saying to me, son, but I also see 30 years down the road, and so I'm going to do something a little bit difficult right here, and you're not going to like it necessarily, but you're going to like me a whole lot later because I didn't spoil you today. My prof, Wayne Mack, said it like this, you can love me now and hate me later, or you can hate me now and love me later, and it really ties into this idea of discipleship. Part of the issue is that we have this thing that's going on in our culture called ethical relativism, and this is a good helpful illustration of it. It's the teaching or doctrine that there are no absolute truths in ethics, that what is morally right or wrong varies from person to person and from society to society. Morality is beholden to the expectant and accepted norms of the current culture. And we're seeing that in our current culture now, where we're being blamed for things that, because that's the new truth. It's ethical relativism. It's the new truth. It's the new way of thinking. There's no anchor to truth. There's no canon. There's no rule to base truth off of. And if you're counseling someone or discipling someone who is beholden to ethical relativism, where they believe that what is happening to me, in fact, I just read this on one of our social media accounts this morning where I was talking about where a person hurts you and you should have an attitude of forgiveness toward that person, minimally an attitude of forgiveness, whether you transact forgiveness or not, you should have an attitude of forgiveness. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And we want to have that attitude of forgiveness. And she said that on that social media platform of ours, she said, no, you've been hurt and you should never forgive. And that is her truth. And that truth that she's talking about is born out of her own deep hurt, born out of her own bitterness that's happening to her. And so truth has evolved. It has morphed for her because now her bitterness is determining what truth is rather than God's word determining what truth is. And that is what ethical relativism is. Let me give you an application. You can't tell me what I don't want to hear. That's ethical relativism. You can't tell me what I don't want to hear. And so if I am in the problem with Rachel, and she says, you can't tell me what I don't want to hear, and I'm not out here, this thing moves. Okay, so I'm out here, I'm on the pier, this is a better position. But if I'm beholding to empathy, you can't tell me, then, well, I'm just all up in it with her, and now she's controlling the conversation, she's controlling how this thing's going to work out, and it won't work out. And if a person says something like this, for example, here's an illustration that I think many of us are familiar with, from about 2016, and it says, believe all women. That's empathy right there. Believe all women. Boom. Believe all women. And you can't say otherwise. Now, many of us struggle with this today. Not necessarily me too. I'm not saying that. But a derivation of that is the cancel culture. We're self-censoring ourselves. The temptation not to speak up. I'm not talking about being unkind at all. But they say, you don't understand me. And it's laced with this manipulation. And you can give in to that. And ultimately, it's not going to save them or you or us if we come at this problem that we have from an empathetic perspective. Sympathy does not dismiss legitimacy. And it's important that you hear that. And so if Rachel or Gloria is trying to pull Dylan out of the ocean, she's not going to, like, so you take the life preserver and you just here, catch it if you can. No, that's not understanding. She wants to do her very best because she truly understands to make sure that he gets it. She's not unkind, uncharitable, harsh, lacking compassion, dismissing the legitimacy of his struggle. Not at all. But she will be sympathetic. You see, sympathy is a macro, a camera terminology, a wide angle perspective, but it's also micro, where it pinpoints. And so with Rachel's problem, we need to give you a problem. I know you don't have any. I'm just trying to come up with one that you might have. You want to confess? You got anything you want to? Nah.
Make something.
Oh, yeah, make something up. I want to understand. I want to pinpoint that. But again, you got to have peripheral vision. You got to see what she can't see, know what she doesn't know. That is the essence of parenting. And parents can't succumb. You know the counting parent? That's the empathetic parent. One. Two. And then they're empathetic because they don't want to hurt the child by bringing some kind of corrective care to this child because he's a spoiled brat. And the empathetic parent will not come alongside with wide angle micro. To suggest a sympathetic person who refuses to drown with you, or to suggest that the sympathetic person will not permit you to manipulate them into their deadly waters, has no compassion. To suggest that, no compassion, is short-sighted minimally and fatal to the victim in its worst case. Now, I am well aware that there are many people who do soul care who don't have compassion. And they throw buoys out like missiles. And I'm aware of that does happen, unfortunately. But it does not negate the truth of this here. Ignorance escalates problems in relationships. And when I'm using the word ignorant here, I'm talking about having a lack of awareness of what I'm sharing with you. Not understanding this, what it will do is it will escalate the problem and complicate the relationship. And so the counting parent, for example, that continues to be an empathetic parent, it is going to escalate the problems of this child as the child goes from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 years of age to 15 to 18 to 25. Because the parent has always been an empathetic parent. It will, and ignorance of what I'm saying here will escalate and complicate relationships. A drowning victim will flail more if you don't jump in. But what you want to do is be sympathetic and give them what they really need. Weak disciplers succumb to this. Weak parents succumb to this. And the hurting has the power. The child now runs the home. The child determines, or the counselee, the person that you're meeting with. Now, I realize that this is really complicated, and I understand it. If you're in a difficult marriage, for example, where one spouse is really angry and harsh and overpowering and those types of things, the temptation would be very much so to just go along, just to jump in, not to be a sturdy spouse, not to be a sturdy discipler, because it's just too hard, it's too confrontational. And I do understand the complexity. And again, as I stated, that this conference here is going to be about interpersonal relationships and personal conflict. And so I'm going to talk more about the complexity, but this particular talk is laying the foundation of which model that you want to embrace. Am I going to be a disciple maker, an empathetic disciple maker, or a sympathetic one? And I trust that everybody will say, well, by the grace of God, I want to be sympathetic as the way that I approach people and not empathetic. Understanding that it's complicated. If the hurting person has power, then they have a self-imposed incarceration. Now they are incarcerated. If my son had the power and we were empathetic, he would be imprisoned to his toe. And there would be no relief whatsoever. Half-truths will keep them captive in victimhood. Let me explain this statement, because we deal a lot with abuse issues. It's rampant, no question. And sometimes when a person has been abused, that they will say what I was implying just a few moments ago, that the counselor was harsh to me, or all counselors are harsh. Therefore, I am not going to expose myself to any kind of soul care, because they're hanging on a half-truth. They're right. The counselor was unkind. The counselor was harsh. The pastor was mean. The pastor was heavy-handed and authoritative. The church was uncaring. The small group would not come alongside me. There's half-truths in all of our victimness. There's always half-truths in our victimness. Many of you know my story. I have half-truths all over my story. Here's my half-truths. My dad was a drunk. My dad beat me. My dad cursed me out virtually every day of my life. I could hang on to those half-truths and be, that the end result would be what the end result was. I was in jail when I was 15 years old. Angry kid in jail because I had a half-truth. I was hanging on. My dad was a mean drunk. It's like, well, yeah, he was a mean drunk. I don't want to be unsympathetic to the reality of what you have gone through as a victim to horrific abuse by a man who is just a horrible man. He died when he was 1977. He was 42 years old, died as a drunk. But because I was hanging on to this half-truth, I felt somewhat vindicated and justified for the decisions that I was making. Therefore, the point before, I was in self-imposed incarceration, hanging on a half-truth that you could not pry away from me because it was the truth. He was mean. And then I had to decide. Am I going to stay a victim and latch onto my half-truths, or am I going to do something impossibly hard? And fortunately, 10 years after that point, at 25, someone was very sympathetic to me. I'm sorry, I know the story. Here's the short version. He said, "You're going to hell." It's like, that's what he said. That was a quote. He said, "You're going to hell." And it's like, wow, that's sympathetic. But he cared for me, and I was sharing with him my beliefs about God in the Bible, which were terrible, and that's why his response, he could only respond like seriously, "You're going to hell." And boom. He wasn't empathetic. I could share that story of drunkenness and, "Oh, Rick, wow, that is bad. I can't believe that. How unkind of a man to do that. No wonder you were in jail. No wonder you like so much Boone's Farm." For those of you under 40, don't even Google it. It's not worth it. It's really not worth it in any way you want to define what I just said. That would not help me. That would not help at all. But a person could come alongside you and say, "Wow, dude, that is really bad. I can't even imagine going through something like that. I don't even have an experience like that. A mean, drunk, angry dad beat you, kicked you, cursed you. Wow." And then at some point in the conversation, a sympathetic caregiver say, "You know, I mean, what's been your reactions to that? How have you responded?" "Well, I'm angry, you know, ended up in jail, et cetera, et cetera." And that person would continue to tease that out and walk me down this path, not jumping in with me and drowning in jail with me, not letting me hang on to my half-truths that you can't pry away from me. I'm kind of realizing halfway through this is not uplifting. This is not one of those, like, we'll pull it out here in a moment. Let's keep pressing on. This is important, though. And part of this relativism that I was defining earlier, that there's really no truth, what's going on here is that it's an assault on hierarchies. I'm going through this book by Carl Truman. I can't remember the name of the book. The Rise and the Triumph of the Modern Self. I just got a word. I heard this voice. It's called The Rise and the Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl Truman. Now, it's a heady piece of work. And so you have to read it in paragraphs and then go walk around the block and then come back and read another paragraph. So just FYI. But he talked about at one point in that book about how mankind has always been breaking authorities, breaking the ceiling of authority. He talked about the agrarian culture hundreds of years ago who were dependent upon the nature, weather, storms, water, wind, and they just lived and died based on that authority of nature, God's creation, not knowing what was coming, what was going to happen next, and so they couldn't break through that authority. And then they began to discover things like irrigation. And when they discovered like irrigation, they could break through nature. They can break through that authority and now have some control. This is Tower of Babel stuff. Now, I'm not throwing shade on farmers. Praise God for farmers and irrigation and tractors with air conditioning and tractors that don't need human bodies in them. Praise God. But I'm just making a point here that we need to be careful as we gain more and more control. He talked about the authority of communication. We have broken through that authority as well. 100 years ago, if you wanted to talk to somebody in England, it's going to take weeks to do that. When John Donne was leaving his wife to go on a trip, to go on a trip meant he was going to be gone for 6 months. And so he wrote a valediction forbidding mourning to her so that she could hang on to it, knowing that he was going to be gone for 6 months. Now, if you want to talk to somebody in England, you can do it in 5 seconds. We have broken through that authority. And we continue to break through authorities in our own penchant, in some instances, to be God ourselves. Now, again, I realize that these are all also mercies that God gives us, but stewarding those mercies are absolutely essential. And so we break through these authorities, and we're seeing that in our culture in real time. There's no more civil authority and governmental authority, and there is no more husband and wife, husbandry authority, pastoral authority. There is a full assault on hierarchies, and there is this equity for all. It's an egalitarian structure that we are trying to create. In discipleship, there has to be a hierarchy. It can't be egalitarian. The sympathizer has to be outside and above. The parent has to be outside and above in order to be a care provider. We can't demolish all of these hierarchies because there's no such thing as truth, or my truth is mine and yours is yours. Here is a beautiful passage of Scripture that talks about sympathy. It is Psalm 40. It is so awesome. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined and he heard my cry and he drew me out of the horrible pit of destruction, out of the miry bog. He set my feet on a rock, making my steps secure. Put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. That is an authority. God is sympathetic. And as you read about the Lord throughout the four Gospels, Jesus is so sympathetic. I mean, just the things that he did and the things that he said, like, seriously, wow, where'd that come from? Didn't see that coming. Never unkind. Definitely a sympathizing Savior, as we read in Hebrews. But this Psalm here is so beautiful, illustrating the point. It takes competence and comprehensiveness to care that well, to parent that well, to be a spouse that well, to be a disciple maker that well. When you mix legitimate abuses, I want you to notice the italicized words here. When you mix legitimate abuses that came from a hierarchical situation into a relativistic culture, there will be visceral and hateful reactions toward anyone standing in the rightful place of authority. Now, that's a powerful sentence right there. And for those of you who do discipleship and you get into a complex case, I'm talking about abuses like in this sentence. Legitimate abuse, you mix it, where the abuse came from a hierarchical structure, a husband, a pastor, a parent, the parent abuses, legitimate, and you mix it in with a relativistic culture to where there is no truth anymore, then that person that you're trying to help will respond with visceral and hateful reactions toward anyone standing in the rightful place of authority because they have a problem with authority. And that was a big issue that I had after God regenerated me, because I only had one definition of what a father is, and it was a horrific one. And this is me. And so I was legitimately abused from a hierarchical situation. I had my version of what truth is because I was ignorantly young Christian. And so basically I was relativistic. And so there was a visceral and hateful reaction toward anyone who's trying to tell me what to do now. I was a sanctification socialist. And you can't offend a sanctification socialist. I'm not talking about necessarily Karl Marx's economic philosophies. I'm just talking about an attitude that you can't talk to. Because I know what truth is, the socialist will say. Even though there is another truth that is the truth, but you can't speak into that. And so we as Christians can become like sanctification socialists and you just can't talk to them anymore. And it has a lot to do with that previous quote. Part of the issue is that this idea is a false argument. And here is the argument. I talked about it earlier. By the way, Rachel is leaving now. We're just watching. I don't understand. I don't understand you. No, it reminded me, this gentleman's leaving. No, I meant to say this earlier. If y'all need to get up, just get up. I won't call attention to you. That'd be rude. That's so rude. Who would do that? But from this point forward, but no, actually, Rachel reminded me about leaving partially. That just get up. Y'all are family, and I kind of feel like we're family too. Because we. Yeah, and you can interrupt like what Brandy just did. It's all good. Yeah. Brandy gives words. She gave me one a while ago. Y'all don't know that, but she gave me a title of a book from Carl Truman. But yeah, go for the stuff over there and go to the restroom and get your water. Stand up. We're not formal here. And so thank you, Rachel. It's a false argument to say that Jesus doesn't understand me. Does he? Oh, I'm sorry. Jesus understands me. And you'll hear that where somebody will say, well, Jesus understands me. And when they say that, they're saying it from an empathetic worldview or an empathetic presupposition. Jesus gets me. God understands. And that's where I'm saying to myself, does he really? Here's some. I want to make a difference. I just want to delineate the difference between Jesus and us. Jesus is not like us. Jesus is different from us. He took on flesh, but without sin. Jesus had no impure motives. He's done little, very little, like us. Never been married, never had children. This is an extensive list. It's an extensive list. And sometimes we say, well, Jesus understands me. That's an elementary understanding of who Jesus is and what Jesus' purpose was on earth. The truth is, we don't want Jesus to be like us. We want someone different from us. That's why he didn't come from Adam. Because he's not like us. We needed something wholly different. And so when we say, well, Jesus understands me, that statement needs a little more nuance. Jesus wants us to be like him. And so it is accurate to say Jesus understands me, but I think many times when you hear that, the person doesn't know what they're saying. Oh yeah, he understands you. He understands more than what you understand about you. And it's kind of like the parent. You know, the parent knows more. This idea, I want to talk about, that's a false argument. Now I want to talk about false opposites. False opposites are, well, here's a definition. False opposites are a pair of words or ideas that give misleading impression that they have opposite meanings. I'll explain that. Right here. Now, some people could say these are opposites. These are opposites. No, that would be a false opposite. These aren't opposites. In a sense, they both have liquid. They're not polarized. They're not opposite. It would be a false opposite to say that these were opposites. It would be false to say that these were opposites. And so these aren't opposites. They look different. This is a Yeti, and this is a plastic bottle. This has something in it, a chemical of some sort. And this has, you like this? It's actually tasty. My children like it. And this has coffee in it. And so they're not really opposites. And sometimes we can create false opposites. Like, so here's an illustration. A Lakers fan and a Celtics fan, and you say, well, those are opposites. This is from the National Basketball Association. The Los Angeles Lakers and the Boston Celtics are basketball teams. I have no affinity to either one. Could care less. I couldn't care less. They say, well, these are opposites. No, they're not opposites. See, both of them are fans. There's Laker fans and there's Celtic fans. Now, one wears purple and gold, and the other one wears, you know, white and green, green and white. But it's a false opposite. Now, why does that matter? Well, let's bring it down to our family. Some people would say that this is an opposite. Understanding a person and correcting a person. No, that's a false opposite. It's not opposite. It's like these two things are false opposite. They're not opposite. This is a Yeti. This is plastic. They serve a similar purpose. One is coffee. One is something else. To say that these are wrong, no, actually understanding a person and correcting them is absolutely essential. Empathy, where it becomes a problem, is what I call the victim-center construct. What you'll have with every situation where you're helping someone who is hurting is you will have what I call the victim-center construct, meaning that they are both victim and sinner. It's a hybrid. And because of this victim-center construct, I was illustrating it with myself earlier about my childhood. I was a victim to the abuses of my father, but I was also a sinner by the reactions to my father. The empathetic person, whether it's the person receiving the care or the empathetic caregiver, they will struggle with the victim center construct. And they tend to lean into the victim part of it, which is where they become empathetic, rather than sympathetic. A sympathetic caregiver will realize legitimate abuse, but we need to give you comprehensive and sturdy care, compassionately and understanding. You remember those first three words when I was defining sympathy? It is with and feeling and suffering. And feeling is understanding. With understanding and suffering. And I talked about a linkage. They're linked together. And it's essential. You can't bypass understanding to bring corrective care. The medical community understands this. If you have false opposites that says empathy is always believing, always kind according to your understanding of kind. See, my son would say that kind is never touch my toe again. Don't get anything within a 12-foot radius of my toe. If I see you walking in the room toward my toe, you're being unkind. If I see you picking up a razor walking toward my toe, I know you're unkind. Because he had an understanding of what kind was. And so empathy is always believing, always kind, according to their understanding of kind, and never challenging. And when you do that, you suppress the truth. Romans 1:18, you press the truth out of the situation. Now you can only use partial truths. You can only help on the victim side. You can't bring full comprehensive care because that truth has been suppressed. You can't speak to the sanctification socialist because they're not going to hear it. They'll only hear one line, one thing. And that person will never be free. False opposites. In this illustration, if you say these are opposites, that caring for me and bringing corrective care, they don't belong in the same space, you'll always suppress the truth. And that can be a dangerous overcorrection. And this is where we get into self-censoring. This is where we get into not stepping into those potential volatile moments. And so we run from the crime, and I'm not going to speak into it. I'm not going to care for my sister at my church because my sister is going to lash out if I speak into that. And so I'm not going to deal with that conflict because I know this conflict is going to be really difficult, and I just don't want to get in it. I'm going to let it go. And so we run from the crime, but that actually creates another crime. We complicate the pre-existing problem. And so now, sister, who's difficult to be with, we run from it, we don't deal with it. Well, it's just not going to auto-correct. There has to be this intentional intruding into this person's life, or these pre-existing problems, she will not only grow in more and more bitterness and hostility and cynicism, but she will start like a bitter root in Hebrews 12, and it will begin to affect other people around her, and it will just make things complicatedly worse. And I've used this word twice already, and this is where we were getting to. It takes sturdy disciple makers. Sturdy parents. Is sturdy a good word? Sturdy. You want to be sturdy. A sturdy husband and a sturdy wife. I think wives need to be more sturdy. Because we men, we come with sturdiness, and that's not necessarily a good thing. We need our sturdiness worked on. I tell people that Lucia's been domesticating me for 24 years now. I'm almost domesticated where you can bring him home, you know. Bring him in the house. Work in progress. People who have been baptized in empathy won't hear this. Now, that's either the hurting person or the individual who should be providing care. I remember a few years ago, many years ago, 15 plus, where someone was talking about a friend of ours, and they said, she has the gift of mercy. And I didn't say anything. I've never said anything about that because I didn't have context or relationship. So I couldn't speak into it. But I thought, she didn't have the gift of mercy. She has the gift of fear of man. She won't say no. She's not sturdy. She won't say no. She says yes to everything. She says yes. Her yes is rarely yes. Her yes is no, but it's always yes. And people look at her and say, oh, she's got the gift of mercy. Look at her. She just does this and does that and does the other thing. So merciful. Marriage falling apart. Children falling apart. That's the gift of mercy, right? No, that's the gift of fear of man. From Adam. And what she needs the gift of sympathy, so when someone comes and asks her to do something, she will just say no. When the rich young ruler came to Jesus and said, I want you to do something for me, Jesus said, I'm just an empathetic Savior, so I just want to jump into all your richness, and I want to show you how to work your way to heaven and how to accumulate more stuff because I'm just empathetic, and I don't want to hurt your feelings. Because I could say something else, and, you know, you'd probably go away sad because you got a bunch of stuff. But I don't want to do that. I'm not a sympathizing Savior. I'm an empathizing one. And so go get more stuff, and maybe you can work your way on to heaven. And the rich young ruler was happy, and he just hung out with Jesus all the time. Now, that's kind of a wormwood paraphrase of that illustration from, is it Wormwood? From C.S. Lewis. Screwtape Letters. Thank you. Boy, I'm just hearing multiple voices today. Thank you. Competence investigates thoroughly. Police accidents in full investigations. This is an illustration. So if the police, if you get run in, if somebody runs into you in an accident and the police come, you don't want them to be empathetic. You want them to be sympathetic, especially if you are the victim, and you want them to investigate thoroughly. And you want them to do some hard things, and they may have to do some hard things. They may have to say some hard things. And you want them to have that kind of thoroughness. All right, let's wrap up. Here's a few questions for you to think about. What is your definition of empathy? What is your definition of sympathy? And remember, as I stated, my caveat was that, you know, I'm not really hung up on the words. Use whatever word you want to use. But how have your definitions changed from the beginning and end of this talk is the more important thing. How do you need to change in light to what you have heard? Do you see yourself as a person who can give directive, caring counsel to hurting folks while knowing that some of that advice may sting a little? Perhaps you're a certified biblical counselor, which is the world in which I live. In the biblical counseling world, there's a lot of people who have certifications. And by the way, that only means they have received some training. That's all it means. They've received some training. But you have a hard time counseling from a sympathetic methodology. My question is that for all of us, will we honestly classify ourselves according to who we are? Not according to our training, not according to any certification, not according to any ambitions, not according to how we think we are or want to be, but will we classify ourselves as to where we really are in this area of empathy and sympathy? Do I struggle? Do I struggle with fear of man? Or I'm sympathetic, but I'm harsh and brutal? Can we honestly classify and then have a discussion about it with those within your sphere of influence? Now, this can be really fun and a great leadership opportunity when two or three gather and start talking about this, and one of those two or three is like, boy, I need to say something here. We need to have a little talk and start practicing this. The big idea, if you do not have a working definition of sympathy and empathy, and more vitally, a practical application of those two words, you may do much harm to those who need your care the most. This presentation was an exploration of clearing up the ambiguity between sympathy and empathy.